Welcome to All Things Marine, Hawaii's thought-provoking show dedicated to marine science and ocean conservation. All Things Marine, brought to you by Kosi Island Earth and the University of Hawaii, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. And now, here's your host, the marine science gal, Carly Weiner.
Aloha. I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal on this Tuesday, February 17th. And I'm really excited for today's show as we're connecting with scientists via satellite on the Schmidt Ocean Institute research vessel Falkor. They are out in the Tasmanian Sea currently doing research on internal waves, chasing giant underwater tides the size of skyscrapers. So without further ado, let's dive right in. First up with us is Dr. Amy Waterhouse from the Scripps Institute of Oceanography. Dr. Waterhouse is the lead scientist on this particular cruise and is joining us now from a boat in the middle of the ocean. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Carly. It's a pleasure to be on the phone with you.
So, now, Amy, most of our listeners are sitting in their office or in their cars here in Hawaii. Can you describe a little bit what it's like to be where you are right now and what kind of conditions you're experiencing?
So, Carly, we're just off of southern Australia, off the coast of Tasmania, and we're about 300 kilometers offshore of Tasmania, and we're on the research vessel Falkor, and we're steaming back to Hobart, actually, after being at sea for the past 25 days. And this morning we woke up and, things were flying around our rooms, and the waves were high, and so we're happy to be going home. The weather's a little bumpy today, but tomorrow it'll be very flat because we'll be out in port.
Excellent. Now, 25 days, it's a really long time to be at sea. Have you been at sea this long before, or was this a first for you?
I have been at sea this long before. Usually we're going to places that take a few days of transit, and then we have a couple weeks of science to do, so it's kind of typical length of a cruise to do. Definitely on this cruise, the weather has been a lot bumpier on previous cruises that I've been on. The Tasman Sea, is known to be a little bit rougher than other areas around the world. And so we definitely had our fair share of storms while we've been out here. So it's been an exciting trip.
Now, I don't think it's just exciting because of the weather, which I'm sure has added an element of excitement. Tell us a little bit about these internal waves or tides that you're looking at. That sounds very exciting to me.
These internal waves are really found everywhere in the ocean. And the Tasman Sea, which is where we've been doing our work and where we'll continue to do work until the middle of March, is a unique place in that it provides this kind of like a little lab of what happens to internal waves. And so internal waves are everywhere in the ocean. They're generated in these places with big topography by the tides. And once they're generated, they propagate kind of all over the place. And so the question we're trying to answer is really kind of the last question in our quest to understand what internal tides and internal waves do in the ocean, and that is what happens to them when they leave where they're generated, and where do they go to die and lose their energy. And so one hypothesis is that they actually do that on steep continental slopes. So Tasmania is one of these steep continental slopes, and so the Tasman Sea offers us this unique opportunity to study an internal wave that's generated just south of New Zealand that travels across the Tasman Sea in this really narrow beam and then slams into the continental slope of Tasmania, potentially losing all of its energy or half of its energy, and then the other half is reflected away. So we're trying to study these processes while we've been out here.
And can you actually see these internal waves, or how do you know where to look for it?
So on this trip, We are measuring internal waves by looking at changes in temperature and salinity and the current speed in the ocean. And so we've been working, part of the group that's involved in the study are numerical modelers, and they've been running models to try and understand, before we headed out, where this internal tide was generated and where we would find it when we're doing our science. And so we were working with them, and now that we've been out here for 25 days, they really had a good idea of where the internal tide was in the middle of the Tasman Sea. And so we went out there and measured, fluctuations in temperature and salinity and velocity, and were able to map out the beam from observations, and it compared very well with the preliminary model results from other members of our group.
Well, that's kind of neat. So you're sort of like the internal tide inspectors trying to model and find where this wave takes place. Now, are there other locations outside of the Tasman Sea where there are these internal waves that are this large?
They're actually, as I said, internal waves can really be found everywhere in the ocean. There are some places where they're generated, and the waves that have been measured are, 1,000 feet high, and they're breaking. Waves were measured a few years ago in the South China Sea, and you can actually see these from the ocean surface. You can see them by looking at bands of the ocean surface, looking at bands of calm water and rough water, and the surface expression of these giant waves that are rolling through underneath the surface. There is actually one of the lead PIs of this project in the Tasman Sea had a really great analogy of internal waves, and he described them as being like the rolling hills of Kentucky moving at jogging speed under the ocean surface. And so if you can imagine all throughout the oceans that there are these waves rolling around, eventually losing their energy as they break into the continental slope. That's really what we're measuring here and what we're most interested in.
That's a great visualization. I love that. I picture these little hills with running shoes on the bottom of the ocean. Now, Amy...
That's right. So we're...
Go ahead. I was just going to say, so when you're not looking at these internal waves or hills running on the bottom of the ocean, I'm sure you are involved in lots of other different research projects, working at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. When you're not dodging 6-foot waves, what else are you doing?
Well, I'm really interested in looking at kind of all processes that lead to mixing, and whether it's out in the middle of the Tasman Sea or even close to home, looking at waves, the similar kinds of waves that run up in, 20 meters of water and are breaking. And working at Scripps in San Diego, when I'm not working, I spend my time surfing. And so when I'm out in the water and I can feel the water temperature change really quickly, I know that, one of these internal waves is right underneath me right now. So it's one of these things that I study that I am in contact with, almost every day, whether it's through my science or for fun.
That's a great way to think about it. And so interesting that it can be that tangible. You can feel it when you're out in the surf. You mentioned ocean mixing. What kind of implications does that have for the ocean life, for the animals in the ocean?
For ocean mixing is really important in coastal environments because it brings up nutrients to the surface that I'm sure our biologist Pete Stratton will probably talk more about a little later on. But it's really important for mixing the water column. And, something that I've been working on at Scripps as another project is looking at the global implications of mixing. And, we're trying to refine these ocean climate models to predict what's going to happen in the future with our changing climate. And it's really important for us to have accurate numbers put into these models to estimate the amount of mixing that's happening in the ocean, distributing the heat everywhere.
Excellent. That's very important. And you also have a very important role on this job, on this cruise, not just to look at these internal waves, but your position as chief scientist. Can you tell me a little bit about what this job entails and how did you obtain this role?
Sure. So being a chief scientist on a cruise is really about organizing and communication between the science party and the ship. And so these big research ships have, many lines of communication and lots of officers you need to talk to give the plan, and lots of different science party members that all have different science goals that they would like to get done on these cruises. And so I'm basically the bridge between the science group on the ship and then the members of the ship's crew. And so on this trip in particular, I've been meeting with the ship's crew every morning, and I go through our goals of the day. And then after, I get updates throughout the day on what everyone else wants to do, and then just relay that information as the day goes on and every morning. And a lot of it is, logistics before and during and after the cruise, and just making sure everything is running and that everyone gets what they would like out of the cruise.
That sounds like a very rewarding but very difficult job. And it's nice to see also a woman in this position. Physical oceanography is a field that really does tend to have a shortage of women. I know this is changing, and there are a lot of aspiring female oceanographers on this cruise with you. What is your perspective on that, and what advice would you give to young women interested in the field?
Yeah, this cruise is really great that the science party group anyway is half men, half women, and a lot of young people on our cruise too, which is always fun and awesome. And advice to any aspiring female scientists or oceanographers is to always follow your passion and what you're interested in. And secondly is to surround yourself with supportive people and coworkers. And in my case, they've usually ended up being my good friends. And I've had the luck of always having really strong female mentors and peers that have been really great role models for me. And they've really been instrumental in keeping me in the field. And, observational oceanography is not an easy job by any means. And being at sea is hard on everyone. And it kind of is hard on everyone equally. But when you have a great group behind you, then it really makes all the difference, especially after a month-long cruise. And so, to aspiring female scientists, I would really say find people and projects that really excite and inspire you, and the rest should come naturally.
I love that. Good people and good projects. Well, Amy, thank you so much. I know how busy you are and getting ready to finish up this expedition. So we really appreciate you coming to talk to us today and look forward to seeing all the interesting things that come out of the research. So if you wouldn't mind, we'll take a quick break here and we will continue chatting with some of the scientists from the Tasman Sea.
Great. Thanks, Carly.
Thanks, Amy. Okay, so Amy, if you want to put Dr. Sam Kelly on.
This is he.
Oh, hi, Sam. Well, you're right there. That's excellent.
Yeah, we're all sitting on the couch here together.
All right. Well, welcome to the All Things Marine, Dr. Sam Kelly, who's the assistant professor with the University of Minnesota Duluth, Large Lakes Observatory and Department of Physics. It's a big mouthful. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
Now, Sam, you are a long way from Minnesota. How has your experience been thus far, month long on the Falkor?
I thought I would be enjoying sort of a second summer this year, but the Tasman Sea is You know, it's not that summery out here. It's been pretty cloudy, and we've been in T-shirts most days, but I haven't seen much of the sun, and it's been pretty rough. So, well, I'm enjoying it, but I'm also not, I'm looking forward to going home as well.
I'm sure looking forward to calmer seas as well. Now let's talk a little bit more about these internal tides. What's your role on the cruise, and what have you been doing in terms of your research on board?
Well, first I should say that there's a lot of overlap between sort of all of the physical oceanographers on the group. We're all kind of working together as a team. But, you know, my sort of individual role has been, I guess I've been a shift leader, so I've been working from sort of noon to midnight, and just making sure that, you know, the sensors are working and that we're doing what we can to get as much data as possible. But on top of that, before the cruise, I did a bit of numerical modeling to try to predict where the beam would be and how strong it would be, the internal wave beam. And so on the cruise, we've just been sort of trying to compare, you know, our predictions to what we're actually observing.
Now, these numerical models that you put together, you use them to look at how the tides form and scatter, or what information do you try and extract from these models?
Yeah, so the models we run, some of them we build ourselves, but a lot of them are sort of community models that have been developed over the last couple decades at, you know, different oceanographic institutes. And they're really just hydrodynamic models. So we solve for velocity and temperature and sea level. And depending on how you force these models, you end up with getting waves. So if we force them with tides and topography, we end up getting these internal waves that have the tidal frequency. And so, yeah, we start with the Macquarie Ridge south of New Zealand, and we force some tides across it. And pretty soon you start seeing waves going in all directions, but especially strong waves going towards Tasmania.
And do all waves act the same, or do they act sort of differently depending on where they are?
Well, a lot of things about the waves, you know, really look the same, whether you're looking at, you know, the ocean or, you know, quantum mechanics or music, you know, acoustic waves. I think the big differences are just things like, you know, the wave speed will depend on sort of the problem at hand. So out here, we're mostly interested in the temperature profile of the ocean and the depth, whereas, you know, in something like acoustics, you'd be worried about the string tension or, you know, quantum mechanics, it'd be something like the speed of light or something like that.
Interesting. You don't really think, you know, I always think go straight to the ocean waves, but there are all kinds of different waves out there. And speaking of the waves in the ocean, you have studied Tasman Sea internal tides or waves for quite some time. Now, what makes this area so special or of interest to you?
Well, the Tasman Sea has, you know, a couple of really nice things. First of all, there's generation all along this ridge, south of New Zealand, the underwater ridge. And the waves sort of form up into this, you know, really focused beam. So there's all this wave energy sort of in a pretty narrow patch, and it's headed straight at Tasmania. So, you know, when there's a big signal, it makes it easier to observe. But another thing that's really nice about the Tasman Sea is that, you know, if you go out into the middle of the open ocean, there's a lot of generation sites. So you kind of see waves that have just been generated and waves that have been, you know, propagating from different locations, and sort of this big soup of waves going in all directions at all different stages of their life cycle. Whereas in the Tasman Sea, we have this really clean, you know, generation, propagation, and then hitting the slope and hopefully dissipating. So we get to see sort of very, you know, distinct pictures of the different life stages of the wave.
I love that. And has there been any information or new things that you've uncovered on this particular cruise so far?
Well, yeah, you know, so being out here and actually being able to make these depth profiles of temperature and velocity, you know, we had some estimates of what the energy might be and how, you know, wide this band of the internal waves sort of traveling from New Zealand to Tasmania would be, but now that we're actually out here measuring it, we're really kind of nailing down these exact numbers, and it's really cool to be able to see, you know, just exactly how much energy there is.
So it all comes down to the energy then. You talked about the wave having this narrow beam, and I know the project title for this expedition has been T-Tide, or T-Beam, as part of a larger T-Tide project. Can you break down these names for us a little bit? Where do these names come from, and how do they relate to the research?
So there's a number of sort of key projects here. So the original project was called T-Tide, which is an acronym for the Tasmanian Tidal Dissipation Experiment. And that originally proposed to just make measurements on the Tasman slope, so within sort of 50 to a couple hundred kilometers offshore of Tasmania. And they were mainly looking at, they wanted to look at the dissipation of the wave. Shortly after that was funded, we found out about the opportunity to use the Felcor. And so we proposed to do a second experiment, which we call T-Beam, and that's to come out here into the center of the ocean and look at the wave before it hits the slope. And so I should point out that you know, we're very happy to be using the research vessel Felcor out here, but both T-Beam and T-Tide, the scientists and all the equipment, a lot of it is being funded by, almost all of it is being funded by the National Science Foundation. And then there's one last T part to this story, and that's T-Shelf. So the shelf is the region sort of, you know, a few tens of kilometers from the coastline, so inshore of the slope. And there's another part of this project, collaboration between the University of Western Australia and Scripps. And this is partially funded by the Australian Research Council, and they're looking at sort of the very end of what the internal tide might be doing as it sort of splashes up and heads right to the coastline.
Interesting. And has the T-Shelf research, have you been looking at the data that they're collecting from that particular project and comparing it with some of the results you've been getting in deeper waters?
So the whole project is sort of running from, it started in early January and it's going to the end of March. So the T-Beam cruise is right in the center of this sort of fieldwork season. And so they just put in the T-Shelf instruments, and we haven't had a chance to look at the data yet, but those will be returning in March.
Excellent. I'm sure after March there will be a lot of data to work with. Are the instruments that they're using on the T-Shelf project different from those that you've been using on Felcor?
So on the Felcor we've mostly been doing ship-based measurements, so we lower a package that measures temperature, conductivity, which we use to get salinity, and velocity, and then a few other things like, you know, we try to measure turbulence and oxygen and fluorescence. The T-Shelf is primarily using moored instruments, so they're actually, you know, dropping instruments to the bottom, you know, to the bottom of the ocean and then leaving them there for a while. And they have some, you know, a whole... I think they put out 8 moorings, so they have 8 different types of platforms. And some of them are profiling moorings that are actually moving up and down using surface wave power. So they sort of ratchet down and then freely float up, and then the waves sort of ratchet them back down. And then they also have some near-bottom instruments that are looking up at the velocities above the bottom.
I love it. All different types of instrumentation to study this wave in different stages. So you've mentioned all the data or all the field collections will be completed in March. And, you know, you oftentimes hear a lot about the science that goes on in terms of the collection, but what happens next? So now you have all this data that you've collected. What are the next steps for you, and how long would that take before you get some kind of answers?
We've been really fortunate that we've there's a number of, you know, really great modelers involved in this project, and so there have already been quite a few predictions made, and so we really are set up now to sort of answer.
Excellent.
Hopefully, you know, by the end of the year, we'll have a sort of a you know, the first big results out But then, you know, we'll start to peel back the details over, you know, years, and, you know, within the next few years, we'll sort of, you know, flush out some of the, you know, other details. But the data is just going to be really valuable, and I expect that, you know, people will still be looking at it, you know, years, if not decades from now. As sort of our understandings change, we can go back and look at the data again and, you know, maybe figure out new things, maybe answer questions that we haven't even thought about yet.
Excellent. And has there been one thing in particular that's stood out to you of an experience or something surprising that's happened on Falkor during this time that you'll really take back with you after the cruise is completed?
You know, it's just, it's really amazing to, you know, we've been looking at this spot on the map for, you know, several years now, and to actually be here and making measurements of things that we've been sort of, you know, modeling and guessing about, and to be able to actually get out here and make a measurement is it's really rewarding, and it's really fun to, you know, to see what's actually happening in the real world. So.
Excellent. Well, Sam, I really appreciate you taking some time to chat with us and sort of map out the process that you go through. And it's, you know, I don't think I realized how coordinated a lot of these efforts are, and it's fantastic to hear about. I look forward to seeing the results in many years to come from this. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we will move on now to our next scientist. Luke, are you on the phone with us?
Hello.
Hi, Luke. Welcome to the show.
Hi, it's great to be with you.
Excellent. So joining us now is Dr. Luke Rainville. Dr. Rainville is from the Applied Physics Laboratory at the University of Washington. So we're just moving our way across the U.S. With all these different scientists on board Falkor, which is located in the Tasman Sea right now. So, Luke, how has your experience been month-long at sea? Is this the first time you've been out at sea for this long?
No, actually, I go to sea fairly frequently, so this is one of many experiments, but they're always really, really fun, and it's always very enjoyable to be at sea with a fantastic group of people and scientists and work together to finally answer the questions that we've been asking ourselves for several years now.
And has it been a very productive cruise for you? I mean, I know you've been dealing with a lot of weather, but have you been able to gather some interesting observations during your month-long stay?
Oh, yes, definitely. It's been a good cruise. Always challenging, especially when you're on ship in the middle of the ocean. There are always problems, whether sometimes weather-related or the instruments and the winch breaks and instrument break, and you have to find resources within your little island, your little ship, to try to really find solutions to keep working. So it's always a fantastic experience, in a sense, to see how resourceful the crew and the scientists are, and how we can all come together to really fix the problems we have and get to do the science objectives that we set out to do. So this has been a good experiment. We've had challenges and weather, as you heard, but I think overall we've been very successful at getting the data that we wanted to get.
You know, that's a really good point. A lot of times you hear about the science that goes on, but you don't necessarily think about the ship as an island and having to be able to problem solve as you go through. I that's a very nice perspective. I like that a lot.
Yeah, no, it's always fun, and also you get to know each other very well, and the collaborations between the crew and the scientists and the officer is always exceptional. So that is, in a sense, what makes it so fun and attractive for all of us to keep going to sea and to keep exploring the ocean the way we do it.
Now, Luke, we've talked a lot about these internal waves or tides and how they've been modeled and how you guys are tracking them down, but I know everybody's doing something a little bit different in terms of their role on board. Can you tell us a little bit about your research and how that differs from Sam Kelly's work, let's say?
Yeah, so as you heard, a project like T-Tide and T-Beam and T-Shelf involve a lot of people. There are probably between 12 and 15 U.S. principal investigators, and if you count the international collaborators, it's well over 2,000 of people that are all interested in the internal tide. And we each bring a slightly different perspective, slightly different tools, and it's really the sum of all those perspectives and tools that makes makes the project a success at the end. So we're all interested in the internal waves in similar ways, but personally I'm working a lot with trying to understand the variability of the internal tide. So just like we heard, you can think of the internal tide as maybe a swell, but unlike surface swells, they're generated by the tide, which is really regular, so you would expect the internal waves to be extremely regular. But we do see that they vary a little bit in time and space. And what I want to really try to understand is what makes those internal waves propagate sometimes a little bit faster, sometimes a little bit slower, what steers them the way that they're steered. So really trying to understand how do they vary and what makes them vary the way that they do.
That's interesting. And so do you have any hypotheses on why some of them maybe are quicker than others, or how are you exploring this more?
Well, you can think of the ocean. The ocean is really a rich soup of motion. So it has fronts and currents that are driven by the wind, and some of those wind-driven currents generate big swirls by meandering. And so there are all sorts of eddies and other motions that fill the entire ocean in addition to those internal waves. And the waves that we're studying are propagating through this complex environment, and they can interact with it the way, as they're traveling through eddies and fronts and currents, and perhaps they can even dissipate and lose some of their energy there. But it certainly steers them and makes them sometimes travel faster or slower. So ultimately, it's all these interactions between those motions is what we're trying to tease apart from the measurements. And a project like this really focuses on this one scale of motion. We're really trying to figure out what the internal waves are doing, but they're really part of a big continuum of motions that we're seeing in the ocean. So trying to get the whole big picture is in a sense what why we're using so many different tools that as we are in this experiment.
Excellent. And you mentioned eddies a lot. I know that's a common term we think of. But for some of us that don't know, can you break down a little bit what exactly is an eddy and how is that important to these internal tides?
So an eddy is a mesoscale. So you can think of the ocean as having different types of time and space scales. The internal waves that we keep mentioning are fluctuation on the order of 12 hours, so their period is 12 hours, and their length scale is a few tens of kilometers. Eddies, on the other hand, are much larger scales, so they have strong currents. They're big swirls that go around and around on a time scale of a week or two or a few weeks, and they have length scales of 100 miles, maybe. So it's these big eddies, and you see them everywhere in the ocean. They're off Hawaii, and they're really kind of dominating the variability on a larger scale. And you can really think of them as affecting the background of the stratification that the waves are propagating through, or the temperature and the biology. And so they're really kind of setting the properties of the ocean that the internal waves are going to propagate through. And similarly, you have a much smaller scale. They have fronts and waves that are generated by the wind, very small scale waves, both at the surface and within the ocean. So it's really sort of a continuing soup of motions that that the ocean is really all filled with.
Excellent. I love it. Studying the motion of the ocean. It's fantastic. And And it's not just, you know, you talked about working together with all these different aspects of research focusing on the Tasman Sea and these internal tides. But I know this particular portion of the expedition is really unique or interesting because there have been two ships working together. So you've got Schmidt Ocean Institute's Falkor and Scripps' research vessel, the Revel. Can you tell us how these ships are working together?
Yes. Yeah. So in a sense, because the ocean is full of all those different motions, the change that you observe from any ship or any mooring has that space and time variability all wrapped together. And to really to tease that space and time variability is hard. And that's why we're using so many tools. We have ships, moorings, gliders, and other ones. And in this case, the National Science Foundation and the Schmidt Ocean Institute were able to work through the schedule so that two ships would be in the same area at the same time working on the same project. And so together, so we're able to get the ships together in a couple of instances and really do joint sampling. So we did in one instance where the two ships were profiling just a few kilometers from each other to try to understand how what one ship would see is if what one ship sees is just time variability or space variability also together. And on in one other instance, we did one ship stayed at the same place collecting a time series, and the Falkor did a quick section to really see what the ocean would look like in a sense if you froze time. And then you can try to look at the mooring data and or the other variability, the other profiles that you get from the other ship to really see what the time variability of that picture is. So kind of trying to really tease apart all those motions and both the science, the space and time variability is kind of what having two ships working together with all those moorings in the water would allow us to do. And teasing all of that apart will take the next several years analyzing the data and trying to figure out exactly what it all means. But having the opportunities to collect that data has been really fantastic.
Well, at least you know you all will be very busy for the next little while.
Yes, we sure hope so.
Now, you mentioned sea gliders briefly. Can you tell me a little bit about those? Because that really captured my attention.
Yeah, so autonomous underwater gliders are one of the other tools that we've been using in this research, and I personally use it a lot for my own research in various projects. But in T-Tide, Sean Johnson and Dan Runnick from Scripps have been deploying gliders here near Tasmania, and I've also been using a lot of the data from gliders that the Australians have been deploying to look at water masses and other processes near Tasmania. So overall, we have about well over 5 years of data. And gliders are these little robots that can stay in the ocean for up to 6 months, and they profile up and down a few times per day. So they're very slow. They're little airplanes that kind of use just buoyancy to go up and down in the water column, and you can drive them a little bit. But they're very slow, which makes that whole question of space and time all wrapped into each other very difficult to interpret. But on the other hand, they are very persistent. So in that sense, all that data from the Australian deployment and from Sean and Dan's glider from Scripps give us a blurry time series of the 5 years of internal waves near Tasmania. And when we combine this knowledge with the really kind of high resolution and precise measurements that we get from the ships, for the months that we've been out here and the 3 months that the moorings have been out there, you can really kind of try to combine all that physics and get a clear picture of what the internal waves look like and how do they interact, how do they dissipate, how do they propagate, and kind of get the whole complete picture. But not a single tool would give you the answer, but it's really by collaborating with all sorts of different people, PIs, and also by using all sorts of different tools that you can really get to the physics.
That's amazing that you have such an array in your toolbox, from these autonomous robotic gliders to these large-scale ships and models. It's it's overwhelming to see how much information can be collected to develop one particular project. That's fantastic. And I know there's another piece in your toolbox, too. You guys have been using a special computer on Falkor for this project. In fact, I think it's called a supercomputer. Can you tell us a bit of how that all fits in together?
Yeah, well, actually, the beginning, one of the big motivations for the project has been those numerical simulations that Sam was talking a little bit about earlier, too. We know, we have a pretty good idea of what the physics, the law of the physics in the oceans are, and if you force the tide going back and forth against topography, you do generate waves. So, for example, Harper Simmons at University of Alaska, one of the PIs in T-Tide, has been doing those numerical simulations, and that's how we found the Tasman Sea as our laboratory for this experiment. And so we sort of, the original motivation for T-Tide has been this, and as we're collecting more and more information about the internal tides, and we're looking at how it does interact through eddies, and we're trying to understand all that data that I've been talking about, one way to combine and assimilate all of that is through numerical simulations and trying to test different background stratifications, for example, to see whether the computer and the model can reproduce the observations that we're doing. So as we've been collecting the information, we've been also trying to do more numerical simulations, and having Nebula, the supercomputer on board Falkor, has enabled us to do a few tests like that already that we will continue after we get off the ship. But these are kind of ways to combine and all the complex measurements and perspectives that I've been talking about are, in a sense, integrated in those numerical simulations. And then we can really try to figure out whether it makes sense and better interpret the space and time variability that we've been observing in directly in the observation. So the computer is sort of a good way to, supercomputer is a good way to assimilate all of those complex measurements.
So it's all about the models. You really need those to figure out where you're going and how to project the science. It's really amazing.
Yeah, it's certainly a very useful tool it's one more tool that we all try to use and understand.
Well, Dr. Ranville, you have a fascinating job between sea gliders and supercomputers. I am so interested to see what kind of results come out of this expedition. Thank you so much for taking some time to chat with us today.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. So last, but certainly not least, we have Australia's own Dr. Pete Strutton with us to talk final thoughts about Falkor, about Tasman Sea, and about the T-Tide expedition. Dr. Strutton is a biological oceanographer from the Institute for Marine and Antarctic Studies at the University of Tasmania. Pete, are you on the line with us?
Yes, I am. Thanks for having me.
Oh, well, thank you. It's a pleasure to have not just yourself, but everybody on the show today. I know it's been a busy month with lots of bumpy seas and a lot to do before you get back to shore. Is there something you're looking forward to going back to once you get on solid land?
My family, I guess. My wife's an oceanographer as well, and both of us go to sea, so we understand, you know, what it's like to be at sea. And but yeah, I'm just looking forward to getting back and seeing her and the kids, and have a relaxing weekend.
Absolutely, after a month out on the ocean, that is definitely well deserved. Now, Pete, you are one of the only biological oceanographers on Falkor right now on this T-Tide project. How is your research different from what all the other physical oceanographers are doing?
Yeah, so in general, my work, I'm interested in the interaction between physical processes and biological processes in the ocean. And most of the time, we look at that sort of in one direction, that, you know, the way that physics stimulates or regulates the productivity of the ocean. There are some examples where biology can feed back onto physical processes. But on this experiment, I'm mostly interested in how the internal waves could be regulating the surface productivity of the ocean. So the when I say productivity of the ocean, I'm interested in the plankton that are at the base of the chain, so maybe I'll just speak a little bit about them. These are photosynthetic plankton, so they're single-cell plankton that contain chlorophyll, so just like plants on land, they perform photosynthesis. And if we look at their place in the global biosphere, they're responsible for about half of the oxygen that's in Earth's atmosphere. So the plankton of the oceans are producing 50% of the oxygen we breathe, and the plants on land are producing the other half. The plankton, the phytoplankton, are also they take up carbon dioxide when they perform photosynthesis, just like plants on land. And so far, of the CO2 that we've put into the atmosphere, the oceans have taken up about a third of that. The phytoplankton, the photosynthetic plankton of the ocean, are partly responsible for that. So they play an important role in regulating the CO2 concentration of the atmosphere. And also they're the base of the marine food chain. So everything up from phytoplankton in the ocean, so including the fish that we rely on to feed ourselves, is stimulated by the productivity at the base of the food chain. So understanding the processes that regulate the productivity at the base of the food chain is really important for everything up from there. So I've been looking at how the physics of these internal waves can stimulate or regulate the productivity of phytoplankton.
And, you know, it's amazing because most people think of, you know, clean air and oxygen, you automatically think of trees. But, you know, the phytoplankton don't really get enough credit, I think, for all that they do. And these are...
That's true.
They're such tiny organisms.
Yeah, so I tell my students, if you want to get an appreciation for how important phytoplankton are, you just skip every second breath.
There you go. Absolutely. And, you know, Pete, they're so small. How do you study such a tiny phytoplankton, or how do you look at that in terms of the internal waves?
Yeah, so Luke was just talking about all the different tools that we use for measuring these internal waves and looking at their impact. And the same is true in all fields of oceanography, is that we, as the field has developed, we've invented and perfected different types of tools for measuring things at different scales. So I guess in the early days of biological oceanography, we did a lot of work looking at what was in the water through microscopes, and I confess that I actually don't do as much of that as I probably should, but that, you know, that's one way that we can look at the different species of phytoplankton that are there. Mostly I do a lot of filtering of water, so I filter water to look at the total biomass of phytoplankton, and so, you know, how many cells there are per litre, or, you know, how much chlorophyll there is per litre, and that gives us an idea of how productive a given region is. We can also use optical techniques, so we can shine blue light on a sample of seawater and measure how much red light is emitted by the fluorescence of chlorophyll, and that gives us another idea of how much phytoplankton are there. And I actually, on this trip, I have a fancy version of a fluorometer that can not only tell us how much phytoplankton are in the water, but it also tells us something about how fast they're moving electrons through their photosynthetic apparatus, so how quickly they're producing oxygen and how productive they're being. And we can also look at phytoplankton from space, actually. So there are satellites that measure the colour of the ocean. They're basically measuring how green any part of the ocean is. And it turns out that the part of the Tasman Sea right over where our tidal beam occurs is a particularly green area of the ocean. And so that points to the potential role for these internal waves in stimulating the productivity of the ocean. So just when we try and study the productivity of phytoplankton in the ocean, we can combine these different observational tools that give us, you know, a view of plankton from, you know, scales of millimetres or less up to scales of ocean basins from satellites.
That's amazing. I love that you can look from a distance and then from up close. So with all these different tools that you have, have you been able to learn anything new on the trip so far, or is it similar to the modeling where it's going to take you a while to go through all that data before you can really put A plus B equals C together?
Yeah, it is a bit of both, actually. The some of the measurements that I've been making, I have to store the samples and they get analyzed in the lab later. It's a kind of instrument that we can't really take to sea with us. But some of the data we've been looking at in real time, and so, for instance, we've been sitting on station in one location with the ship for up to 30 hours at a time, and we've been constantly profiling the upper part of the ocean at about the upper 200 metres with a small instrumented package that allowed us to look at the changes in the physical and biological processes. So we've definitely seen as these waves propagate past our location, they change the vertical structure of the ocean, and some of the more detailed lab measurements that I've been making that we'll analyse later will be able to look at the biological impact of those processes. As I mentioned, we can also look at the productivity from space. Unfortunately, those satellites can't see through clouds, and it has been quite cloudy most of the time we've been out here. But what we can do is perform like a retrospective analysis. We can look at how the productivity of this part of the ocean changes from, you know, these satellites have been up since the late 90s, and we could look at historical data to see how the productivity changes through the cycle of the tides, and that way we could get an indication of the importance of these internal tides and internal waves for stimulating productivity at the surface.
Wow, it's you know, a wealth of information, and it's very exciting. So if you were going to communicate one final thought about phytoplankton productivity and the Tasman Sea, what would that be?
Yeah, this place, as everyone else has mentioned during their discussions, it's one of the most active, probably the most active place in the global ocean for these internal waves. And it definitely looks like they're playing a role in stimulating productivity. We can tell that from satellite. And if we can understand how these internal waves are stimulating productivity in this part of the ocean, we can then expand that to other parts of the ocean where these internal waves are active and understand their role in regulating productivity elsewhere. And as I said before, just generally understanding the productivity of the oceans is important for, you know, production of oxygen, uptake of CO2 out of the atmosphere, and feeding the whole ocean food chain.
Well, Pete, you have definitely reminded me to not only think trees but phytoplankton for the air we breathe, and also really piqued my interest in a lot of this work that you're doing. I'm sad to say we're running short on time here, but certainly not on interest. If our listeners want to learn more about the Tea Tide trip, they can visit the Schmidt Ocean Institute website at schmidtocean.org and follow along with the cruise. I want to take a moment here to thank all of my guests for taking some time to speak with us today, all the way from the middle of the Tasmanian Sea in Australia. And we wish you guys a really safe journey home, and hope you get to dry land soon. So thank you very much to all of you for your time. And thank you to Schmidt Ocean Institute, as always, for helping with this expedition and with the show today. And thank you to our sponsors, the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology and Kosi Island Earth. I'm Carly Weiner. Now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.